Multnomah. So I started an environmental science program. And I've been a Christian my whole life. I currently attend Westminster Presbyterian in Vancouver, Washington. I have a wife, three children, 5, 3, and 1. And so my wife wanted to be here, but she realized she would probably be in the lobby with our one-year-old. So that's a little bit of personal history. And so here we are, and I really appreciate this topic. And first time I've been able to speak to this topic in particular, and I'm excited to do that, looking at science, environmental science, and environmental politics. And so I would imagine there's probably some broad understanding or broad agreement here that we ought to be stewards of our environment. We ought to care that God has called us to do that. He's called us to care for the environment. But on the other hand, I would imagine that there's probably some, at least among some of you, perhaps some skepticism, or in terms of when you hear media or scientists perhaps talking about what we ought to do in light or with respect to the environment, right? And the media, scientists are predominantly going to be coming from a worldview that would not be Christian and is probably antagonistic oftentimes toward Christianity. And so what I want to do is help to distinguish between the science and the politics. So there's this conflation and confusion. So I want to help try to equip you to be able to distinguish the science, make your own judgments regarding the science, and then also make your own judgments in terms of what we ought to do in light of the science. So that's what I'm going to try to do. I would consider myself successful today if you can walk away from here being able to have a regard for, say, the science of a world-renowned scientist in a particular field, have a regard for the science, but not necessarily agree with him or her in terms of what ought to be done in light of that science, okay? And so scientists, if they're interviewed on the news, for example, they're very quickly going to be asked questions that they didn't get their PhD in, right? And so they're going to be stretched and moving beyond they're going to be asked, what should we do, right? But that's not necessarily what they're trained to answer, right? So I want to help us to make that distinction. So here's the outline for our discussion. And first, we're going to talk about what is science. And this is where I'm going to spend, that red one is going to be the bulk of the talk, okay? Some of the more juicy stuff is below, and I'm not going to spend as much time there. It's really about developing critical thinking skills, and if we want to think critically, we have to define our terms, we have to understand what science is, we have to understand what it can tell us and what it can't tell us. And then once we have that understanding, I want to try to apply that to a case study, so we're going to apply that to climate change in particular. That seems to be the hot topic of the day, right? Yeah, no pun intended, yeah. And then a bit about where to go for scientific information, and then very little about what to do about it. Again, that you're asking somebody that I didn't get my PhD in what we ought to do about climate change. Okay. So first, what is science? This is a painful definition. Okay, this is the worst slide of the presentation. It stretches me, but that's what we're here to do. We're here to be stretched. And so the most careful thinkers are philosophers. Okay, philosophers, that to me, philosophy is about thinking carefully. Okay, and so this is a definition of natural science from Del Ratch, who's a professor of philosophy of science at Calvin College, so a Christian. And so natural science is a theoretical explanatory discipline that objectively addresses natural phenomena within the general constraints that, one, its theories must be rationally connectable to generally specifiable empirical phenomena, and two, it normally does not leave the natural realm for the concepts employed in its explanations. So that's, there's no mass exodus yet. Okay, that's good. So we're going to break this down. Okay, I want to highlight some key words. Okay, explanatory. So what science is trying to do is to explain. Okay, so it's not just observing what we see, but explain why. Okay, so it's going to try to do that. And it's going to try to do so objectively. Okay, and we'll get into each one of these. And so, obviously, pure objectivity is not going to be possible for sinful, finite humans, but we're going to do our best. It's rational, okay? And so we use reason. It's based on reasoning. It's empirical. That's a fancy word for we use our five senses and we develop instruments that are better than our five senses to detect things that we couldn't see, etc. Okay, so that's it's trying to expand our reach of observation. Okay, so it's empirical. And another key word is natural. It does not leave the natural realm in its generally in its explanations. So as a Christian, you probably believe that there's more than we see, right? I believe that. And so that places a limitation on it. So that's going to dictate what it can answer and what it can't answer. Okay, but there's a lot out there to look at. So there's a lot out there that it can address. Okay. So let's go through some of these more closely. So science is rational. And what I'm gonna try to make the argument is that Christianity and Christian doctrine has the best foundation for doing science. Or that science actually depends on presuppositions of Christianity. And actually, the modern science, even if it's rejected Christianity, still borrows the framework that Christianity validates. Okay? I totally believe that. Okay? That is the situation. Okay? And so I'm going to make this case that the Bible is going to support this. Okay, science is rational. God himself is rational. Come now and let us reason together, says the Lord. Okay, Isaiah 1:18. He uses reason, and he made us and expects us to use reason as well. Right? We are rational. We are made in the image of God. He's rational, we are rational. Okay, Genesis 1:26, God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. Third, creation is rational. Okay, so Genesis 8:22, while the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. So what do we see there? We see that there are patterns and regularities that we can depend on. How are you going to start doing science if there's nothing to fix your observations on? There's no regularities, there's no pattern, it's just chaos out there. You know, summer is going to come directly after winter. You know, we're going to skip spring this year, you know, right? There are there are repeatable regularities built into creation, okay? And so that is absolutely necessary for us to go out and to observe, okay? And so Christian doctrine provides the rationale for doing science. If God himself were not rational, and if we were not rational, we would be incapable of doing science. What reason do we have to think that we are rational if we're not made by a rational being? Okay? So you see how science borrows this framework, even if it rejects the creator. A scientist, particular scientist, rejects the creator. It's borrowing the framework that we are reasonable. That's not something that you can just assume without providing a justification for it, right? The Bible provides the justification for doing science. We are rational, okay? Okay, so science is rational. Science is empirical. Okay, so creation is a free act of God. This is implied in Genesis 1. Genesis 1 does not say the mysterious initial primordial laws force God to create the heavens and the earth. That's not in my version, right? Okay, so God, there was nothing, and then there's something. God, creation ex nihilo, God created something out of nothing. Okay? He chose to do it. Okay, so if it said, you know, there's these mathematical equations that started it all, God was just the agent, you know, forced to do this, we would never have to leave this room. We could just, you know, get on a chalkboard and we should be able to figure everything else should just stem from that, right? If it's all can be boiled down to natural laws and to mathematics, everything should just extend from it, but that's not the case. And so we have to go look and see. Okay, we have to, I think the Bible provides the basis because God is freely created. He did so in the way he chose, so we have to go figure out what he did. Okay, we have to go look. Okay, another implication of the Imago Dei, or the image of God, is that we can trust our mental faculties to access the truth. Okay, and so the image of God, that was present prior to sin, and it's still there. Okay, and so he has given us the ability to access the truth, okay, even despite our sin nature, okay? And the scientific enterprise borrows this as well, right? What reason to believe that we can get at the truth, right? If you believe in purely naturalistic evolution, what reason do you believe that you're actually able to access the truth if you just if it's all mechanical and all material, right? So that's another presupposition that is borrowed, okay, in modern science and is justified by Christianity, okay? Science is objective, okay? I put at least in part. All right, so there's been a long controversy in the philosophy of science and history of science and how objective it is, right? And so pure objectivity is not achievable due to sin, and subjectivity is going to creep its way into the scientific process throughout. Okay, it's inescapable. When a scientist is going to believe certain things, that it's going to dictate the methods that he or she uses, that's going to produce certain data, and that scientist is going to bring their subjective framework into interpreting the data. Right? So there's some subjectivity there that's really hard to get away from. Okay? However, there remains a substantial core of perceptions that are neutral. They're shared by nearly all humans, and they provide objective constraints, often leading to scientific consensus. Okay, so here's an example. Nearly all humans believe that the Earth has one moon. Okay, that is neutral, shared by nearly everybody, and so that's about as close to certainty as we can get. We have one moon. Okay, so that there are objective constraints to science. Okay, so you have perhaps individual subjectivity, but collectively there are some constraints to make it more objective. Okay? We can safely dismiss any current theories that say that the Earth has four or five moons, you know, something like that. Okay. Any questions so far on that? We'll have Q&A at the end. No one is left yet, and feel free to do if you've had enough. But I just want to make sure that, are we okay? Okay so far? Okay. Non-verbally, that's what you're telling me, but I would like the verbal confirmation as well sometime. Okay. Yeah, you could just be very gracious people. So, okay, another implication of the Imago Dei is common grace. He sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. Matthew 5:45. Yeah, the teacher of Ecclesiastes seems to lament that the righteous or the unrighteous prosper, and the righteous do not, right? I'm sure we'll all have plenty of questions for God when we get to see him, right? And so what I take from this is that the scientific community, even though many scientists have perhaps abandoned the Christianity, have still maintained the framework, and they've still able to do science based on that framework to great success. Okay? And so I think that is common grace. At Stanford, I was surrounded by non-Christians who are way better than I was. You know, very humbling experience, right? And they did great, great science. And so that's some, hopefully gives you a little framework for the nature of science, a little bit of, you know, reaching back into elementary school when you had to do your science fair projects. This is a diagram about the scientific method or the approach. So you start with some question or prediction or hypothesis that you have based on your initial observations, and then you design an experiment to test that hypothesis. Based on these observations, you might modify your hypothesis. You might change your question, right? And then you develop new experiments, and then you try to come to some conclusion. It's really a never-ending process. You know, unless you finish your degree and you've just had enough, then you can end it, right? But really, there's always more to do, right? And so this scientific process produces laws and theories, okay? And so we looked at that atrocious definition of science, and so I want to continue to define our terms here. So law, a scientific law and a scientific theory, because they're often not used correctly. Okay, so a scientific law is a brief statement that summarizes past observations and predicts future ones. Okay? And so an example would be the law of conservation of mass. Okay, so in a chemical reaction, matter is neither created nor destroyed. Okay, so in every chemical reaction we've observed to this point, this holds. And so we expect that to hold in the future. Right? That's a statement of what we've observed and what we expect to continue to observe. Okay, that's a scientific law. So it allows you to predict future observations, and you can test it, the law, through experimentation. Okay? Unlike civil or governmental laws, you cannot choose to violate a scientific law. Okay, so you know, gravity is not too concerned about whether or not you're going to submit to its authority, right? It's going to send you down the hill regardless of how you feel about it, right? So that's a scientific law. A theory explains why. So the law is more what we see, and the theory is why. So if you're going from what to why, you can imagine a little bit more uncertainty with theories than laws. Okay, a little bit more. So one or more well-established hypotheses form the basis for a scientific theory. So it's a model that tells us the way nature is and tries to explain why, not merely what it does. Okay? That's what a scientific theory does, and they are also validated by experiments. This is something that you will probably not hear, and you may have not heard unless you've studied the philosophy of science. Theories can never be conclusively proven true. They can never conclusively be proven false. Okay? This gets a little bit technical. I'll try to explain each of these briefly. So the first one, theories can never be conclusively proven true. There are always more data that can come out and challenge the theory and actually show it to be inadequate, right? So there's always new data, new experiments that can run counter to a particular theory, okay? And also, science involves bridging the gap between the seen and the unseen, and so there's inherent uncertainty there. So for instance, we have never seen an electron, but we're pretty sure they're there, okay? But there is inherent uncertainty there in terms of what they are. We can't, it's stunning, right? We can't, I love this. This is what I'm going to ask God when I get up there, okay? We can't define the energy level and the position of an electron at the same time. We have to choose which one. Okay, and so in quantum mechanics, we choose to define the energy level and we punt on the position. So if you've heard of orbitals, those orbitals, we basically say they're probability maps of distribution. This is where we would likely find this electron within this volume that has this energy. Okay, so it's quite humbling, in my opinion. And so there's inherent uncertainty, right? And so a theory can never be conclusively proven true in a strict sense, okay? It also can't be proven false. And so if you think of a theory as this complicated apparatus, okay, that's really depending on all kinds of things, It's depending on all kinds of sub-theories. Is my instrument working properly? Is the theory behind my instrument correct? Right? And so it's dependent upon all these sub-theories that all have their uncertainties. And so if your results of your experiment don't line up with your theory, then you have to troubleshoot. right? So it's you can't conclusively say that your theory is wrong. It's maybe that your instrument wasn't working, right? And so all this to say, there is an inherent tentativeness to science, okay? But now that brings me to this distinction between certainty and confidence. Here are a few sentences. I exist. 2 + 2 = 4. All bachelors are unmarried. Okay? This is about all I can be truly certain about in life. So any philosopher will not dispute these things. Anything you add to this list, a philosopher will probably start to dispute. Okay, so there's very little that actually meets the criteria of pure certainty. So certainty really isn't available to us in life, right? I exist, mathematical operations, and things that are true by definition. That's about it. Okay, so certainty, God doesn't give us certainty in life about a whole lot of things, right? And so we operate in faith in the midst of some degree of uncertainty. Science is no different. Okay? However, we can have confidence. So certainty is not that's not the criterion to evaluate science, because there's not much we can be certain about anyway. So it's not really a valid criticism or way to critique science, because it's not really available to us. This is a graph of a paper that I published earlier this year. Forget about what it says. All I'm trying to show you is here are some data. And you see those bars around the data points? Okay, some have very little bars and some have big bars. Those bars are called error bars or confidence intervals. Okay, and so I perform an experiment a few times. I can't tell you for certain where each data point ought to be or where it is in reality, where God would put it. God knows where it is, I don't. Right? And I repeat the experiment, there's difference. And so that's what the whole field of statistics is about. It's trying to quantify our confidence. We can't have certainty, but it's trying to quantify the amount of confidence we can have. And so that error bar is saying, it's a mathematical way of saying, I am 95% confident that that point is somewhere in that range. So there, by dumb luck, there's this 5% chance that I could be wrong. Okay? But so in a scientific paper, if you don't see error bars, I would be more suspicious than if you do. Right? If there are error bars, at least they're acknowledging that there's uncertainty there. When I review a scientific article and there's a graph with no error bars, I send it back. I'm not going to accept it unless you show me how many replications and show me your level of confidence in this data. Give me confidence in it. Did you do it once? That's not good enough, right? My advisor made me do it way more times than that, so I'm going to make you do it too, right? So, okay, so that's the diff. So certainty is not something we can achieve, but we can develop confidence, okay? So I told you that the focus was at the beginning, right? So now that we understand what science is, more about its nature, what kind of questions can it answer? And so here are some examples. Why do apples fall from trees? Okay, that is a theory. So it's asking a why question. So that's the theory, that is Newton's theory of gravitation. Why apples fall from trees. How can we improve corn yields? We've gotten pretty good at this through experimentation, right? All land-grant universities, they have research, they have extension, and they've they've optimized this pretty well through experimentation, right? What causes arsenic contamination of groundwater in Cambodia? That's a question near and dear to my heart. That we can answer that. We can answer that scientifically. Okay. What can't science tell us? How does something come from nothing? So you remember in that definition, it doesn't leave the natural realm. So I have trouble thinking about nothing. Okay? So if you are able to study nothing, then it is an object, and so then it's something. Right? I can't comprehend what nothing is. So God created something from nothing. That's beyond our instrumentation, right? So there's a limit what we can do there. So science tries to get, you know, milliseconds to from the beginning. It tries to get there, but I think there's an acknowledgement that we can't get to the very beginning, right? Whom should I marry? I don't recommend that you do experimentation, you know, to figure this out, or experimentation in terms of is it better to live or to die, you know. Those are not accessible to us through science. Those questions. What is the good law? These are ethical questions. Okay, so that those are some things that science can't answer. So now let's apply this framework to climate change, okay? So I think two most common questions that you hear are, is climate changing and are humans contributing to the change? Okay, so can science answer these questions? I would say yes, it can answer these questions. Can science answer these questions with certainty? Can I hear? No. Okay, good. Yes. You follow. Yeah. No. Can science answer these questions with some degree of confidence? Yes. Now, that degree is going to be where the question is, where the dispute is. Can science tell us what we ought to do about this? I would say not by itself. Okay, so I think it can provide information and tools, but this is ultimately an ethical question. Okay? I think there are many scientists that probably don't make this distinction very well, and they see what we ought to do coming from and dictated by the data, right? And I don't think that's thinking too carefully about this, right? So here are, this is the only other graph I'm going to show. These are data from the last 6,000 years looking at temperature, so global mean annual Earth surface temperature and CO2 levels in the atmosphere. Okay, and so the CO2 is on the bottom and the temperature is on the top. So we're looking at time on the x-axis and then the vertical are changes in CO2 level and temperature. And so you could see that they go together, typically, they go together, and that there isn't a whole lot of change until you get to that dashed line, and then they both go up. Okay, so temperature goes up, CO2 goes up. See the spike at the end of the graph, right? that dashed line is when industrialization begins. So you have the dashed line, and then you have these spikes. Okay, so this is one data set that shows that CO2 and temperature go together, and CO2 is about as high as it's been in a long time. So if this is continued to hold, we would expect temperature to follow that. So, is climate changing and are humans responsible? We can't, this is one data set and it is not going to say with certainty, but you can make your own assessment. Okay, this is just one graph. There are many more to look at if you're interested in. Okay, so I think science can provide answers with some degree of confidence, but without certainty. Okay. So why ought Christians care about environmental challenges? I think it's our job to care. So the Lord took the man and put him in the garden to work and to keep it, Genesis 2:15. So yeah, if Adam were not kicked out of the garden so quickly, you know, you'd expect that if, you know, environmental conditions were to change in the garden, that'd be something he'd want to learn about and know about in terms of how to manage that garden, right? You shall love your neighbor as yourself and give justice to the weak and the fatherless, maintain the right of the afflicted and the destitute, rescue the weak and the needy, Psalm 82, verses 3 and 4. So I would say even these things hold even if humans, whether they are involved in amplifying climate change or not. I think these statements hold, whether or not humans, you come to the conclusion that humans are involved in this process or not. Global sea level is rising. This is global mean sea level. For the past 140 years or so, and it's increasing, and it's increasing at an increasingly fast rate. Okay, sea level is increasing. That's pretty well understood. I don't think anyone is disputing that. And so this is what we've observed, is that this is disproportionately hitting the equatorial regions of the Earth. Okay, and so here you tend to have a lot more poverty, a lot less wealth, a lot less resources. We've seen a lot of effects of sea level rise. We've seen saltwater intrusion, which affects water supply. It affects agriculture. You have coastal erosion. So you have about over 80% of the world's population lives within, I think, 62 miles of the coast, right? And so there's a lot of much of the world's population is going to be affected by changing sea levels to some degree. And so if this is happening, regardless of whether humans are contributing to the problem, it seems to me that Christians should be in the conversation and action in terms of how to help communities that are facing this challenge. Right? What do we do about climate change? Again, I'm not an expert. That would be moving beyond my field. I think the academic discipline that I think is probably best suited to address this would be natural resource economics, okay, which tries to figure out how to build and operate human economies within the natural constraints of our limited resources, and to do so in a sustainable way, okay, that have sustainable economies and be able to sustain our environment. And I think it also involves questions about the roles of government, private industry, non-governmental organizations, churches, individuals, etc. So people involved and institutions involved at various scales. So, where do we go for scientific information? Okay, so for environmental science information, if you're just now that hopefully you're equipped to perhaps distinguish science from when it bleeds into politics, you can start to evaluate these sources for yourself, right? And so, the National Academy of Science. Is the most prestigious scientific organization probably in the world. They're going to have resources online for various environmental challenges, you know, water security, energy security, climate change. American Geophysical Union, of which I'm a member, is the largest organization of earth scientists in the world. They have resources online in terms of various environmental challenges. Now, you got up early this morning. I think you're hungry for knowledge. You want to learn, and so I expect that you are ambitious people. And so, this is for those that want to go a little deeper. I would reach out to local scientists. So if you have a particular question that you're interested in, I would Google different local universities and the scientists in their department and ask them, who do they think the expert, who are the experts in this field? Who are the experts in sea level rise or whatever your question is? And ask multiple scientists. I think you'll start to corral a body of individuals that you can start to look at what they've done. And you can look at scientific lectures on YouTube. The best and most difficult thing to do is to go to the primary literature yourself and not be intimidated by it. And so Google Scholar is a great search engine where you can search, put in search terms and look at primary scientific literature for a particular question. And a lot of that is free and open access now. Some things you would have to be associated with the university to get, but there's a lot that the general public is available to the general public. And so let me give you just a quick tutorial on how to read a scientific paper and not be intimidated by it, okay? And so they all have the same structure, okay? So they start with an abstract, which is the summary. Okay, and so, and these should be written, you won't always find this to be the case, they should be written to people that are not in that discipline. Okay, they should be written that in an accessible manner. Again, you will find many counterexamples to this. But they ought to be, and some are. And so, in a very succinct fashion, they should be written in this outline that I'm going to give, and you will find exceptions there as well. But basically, a statement of the context, what is the problem? What are they trying to, you know, what do we know? What do we know? And then what is the particular, what are we limited in terms of our ability to understand at this point? Like, what is the question that this research is solving or attempting to solve? And then it gives quick how they do it, and then a quick synopsis, a sentence or two of what the data show, and then relating that data to the what is known. Okay, so they're embedding their work into the broader knowledge of the scientific community. Okay, and so it's a very quick way to look at what they've done. From there is an introduction, and that's often actually easier to read than the abstract. The abstract's really tight and compact and dense. But the introduction gives more of the context for what is known and the rationale for why they're doing this work. What questions are they trying to, what questions still need to be answered? So they provide you the context. Then there's the method, so how they do it. You can skip that if you want. You can give it a go. But all these papers have gone through peer review, and so some things, I think, slip through the cracks, but there has been some rigor. There is some of that objective constraint where these methods have been accepted by the scientific community, okay? And so if we accept the methods, then the next section is the results, and if you accept the methods, then the results are not really in dispute. Those are the results based on those methods. What is then in dispute is the discussion. Okay, so the discussion is interpretation of the results. And this is where you get a little infighting and bickering. They might elevate their work and dismiss somebody else's, or say our study aligns well with these, or it doesn't align well with these because of this. Okay, so this is where the scientific community is trying to work things out, right? So there's probably some theory out there that a shared theory people are working under, and they're working out the details. Okay, this is where it gets modified. This is where the current work is placed into the conversation. Okay, of what's going on. Okay, and it's pretty. I find it entertaining, right? When you get a little digs here and there, and not personal, but kind of scientific soap opera a little bit. Depending on the field, I guess. And then you get the conclusion, which is a little bit more fleshed out version of the abstract. And so I would encourage you to not be intimidated and give primary literature a go. This is the primary source. And so what you'll notice on here is that I didn't put the news. I didn't put the newspaper. Okay, so that you see how you're getting removed from the science and where the conflation of science and politics is going to be embedded there, right? So, again, as I mentioned before, a scientist interviewed on CNN or MSNBC or Fox News, they're going to be, the interviewer is probably not going to be equipped to ask them questions about their methodologies, and the viewership probably is not going to be critique that. It's more what does the audience want to hear, and depending on the network that you're listening to, you've already self-selected the audience, you've self-selected the scientists that you're interviewing, right? And so you're distancing yourself with these layers of conflation from the primary literature. So just go to the source, okay? Or get help from other from scientists. Okay, what to do about it? This last slide. Obviously, where to turn, first and foremost, always is the Bible in terms of how we, when thinking of questions of ethics and what we ought to do. And I would also look at Christian scholars and thought leaders in relevant disciplines. So they'll often have books that are more accessible than the primary literature, be more of a summary of what they've done. And so it's easier to read than journal articles. I find Christianity Today has some good articles in terms of with respect to the environment. And then also Christian non-governmental organizations and mission organizations. So a couple examples would be Evangelical Environmental Network or creationcare.org, and then also Care of Creation or careofcreation.net. So this will give you an idea of what some Christian organizations are doing to address environmental challenges that we face. Okay. This is the last slide. So then, these are three books that I feel like motivated a lot of what I said. So Del Ratch. That first one is really a philosophy of science. So if you want to dig deeper into the nature of science and its limits, you'd go there. Vern Poitras. Has a lot more degrees than I can even name at this point, but he's a mathematician, a theologian, a philosopher, and he's done a great job, I think, of showing really the compatibility of the Christian worldview and science, and the Christian worldview actually provides the basis for doing science, and science actually depends on those presuppositions. And then Tolle and Block, these are professors at Wheaton, environmental scientists, professors at Wheaton, and they give some perspective. They try to do a biblical perspective on what we ought to do about various environmental challenges, such as water security, food security, climate change. So, what is a Christian approach to these challenges? So, thank you for your time, and I'm open to any questions that you might have.
Mm-hmm. Temperature rise. It was very provocative, you know, mm-hmm. to see that mm-hmm. change. So my skeptical side says, how can you measure CO2 so many centuries back? It's like, you know, I thought, what was the temperature inside my car 4.5 weeks ago? How do you know?
Wonderful question. Yes. So that's going to be from ice core data. And that is the CO2 level. So we have ice sheets that are deposited annually in the winter. And so you can date them by the number of sheets. Okay? And then entrapped in the ice, you're going to have the atmosphere at that time. Okay? And so the atmosphere is going to have a CO2 level that you can measure directly. Okay? And then using isotopes, natural stable isotopes. So water, H2O, has hydrogen and oxygen. Hydrogen has 3 isotopes. So there's a heavier and a lighter and a medium. And they all have their own natural abundance. Same with oxygen. So O16, O17, O18. They have different weights and different natural abundance. And scientists have developed an empirical relationship between those ratios and the temperature. So it's an indirect measure of temperature. It's not direct. It's indirect. So they've established that based on the levels of those isotopes, the ratios of the oxygen ones and the hydrogen ones, they've developed a relationship where they can infer the temperature that ice sample was at. Okay, and so it is indirect. So that there's an example where you have to buy into the methodology, right? It's an indirect measure. There is scientific consensus that this is an accurate thing to do. Should that satisfy you? No. You know, if maybe not. So you know, that's something where you can look at that empirical relationship that was developed and see if you think that that is valid or not. That's a wonderful question. Yeah. Does that answer? Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Relative to environmental science, environmental politics, how would you incorporate follow the money in relation to those two terms, whether it be government or a non-government organization?
That's a great, great question. So I that hits home a little bit because I see in academia, funding for science generally decreases and doesn't increase. Maybe there, with different administrations, you might have a little ebb and flow there. But for a National Science Foundation, NSF proposal, the acceptance rate is about 5%. So you have a 95% chance of not getting funded. It's an extremely competitive environment. And so you want, when you're doing research, you want to have a compelling narrative in order to get the money to do the research. So I think there is some motivation that perceived, you know, catastrophes and such can be exploited to some degree, right, in order to fund, to write a compelling narrative. And maybe that they are true catastrophes, or maybe not. So that I do think, in terms of following the money, the scientific community is going to shift toward big, high impact questions. So even in my field of soil chemistry, I've been in it, there's been a shift from dealing with, say, metal contaminants and oil contaminants of soil and stuff like that to How are soils involved in the global carbon cycle? So soils are the largest pool of carbon that's actively cycling in the world. There's more carbon in the soil than there is in all of vegetation and in the atmosphere combined. Okay, and so that's a compelling narrative, right? And so the research has shifted to say, how do soils regulate the climate, right? And so I can speak to it from that perspective, especially in terms of motivations for research. It's certainly very much related to money in that respect. So I still, within that context, I still think that we can equip ourselves to distinguish between what is science and what is political. I think that there we can, if we think critically, we can distinguish that.
Mm-hmm. Colleen, right there, Don Anderson, and we'll make this the last question, Dr. Stuckey.
You want me to have?
No, right there, that form.
Ah, thank you. Testing, there we go. Mm-hmm. I have always an ironic smile as I look at the basic Darwinian evolutionary viewpoint of science as a platform that we experience these days. Survival of the fittest, species eliminate each other. And then you've got apocalyptic scientists on the other side. And if we don't do something, we're going to be eliminated. So, you know, the disconnect. We have the same thing spiritually. We have the Calvinistic view. God's in charge. We really can't do anything. We just need to go along for the ride. Mm. And then the Arminian view saying, we really have a lot to do here, and God's given us responsibility. So as a scientist and as a professor, how do you dangle precipitously between those things and live your life out in a way that you're called to be a Christian?
Wow. Yeah, that's great. So I guess I would go, you know, that our chief end is to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. And so what does that look like, you know? And so I think we are called to be faithful with what we're given in terms of our resources, our intellect, our abilities, our skills, our gifts, that we need to take those, and I think God expects us to use those faithfully, and we'll give an account of how we've done. And to me, it's exciting the liberties and freedom He's given us. I think if we raise our children well, we can equip them to use their gifts in a way that is glorifying to God. And I think He's invited us into the process. And I do think that there are real consequences when we mess up in all areas of our life, that He has allowed for consequences at various scales. And I'm not obviously an authority to determine what he's deciding what the consequences are, and you know, I might see some correlations here or there, but that's not for me to decide. But I do think that we, wherever you fall on that spectrum, I do think that there is a role for us to play. And to me, it's exciting to be entrusted with the garden as He is entrusted Adam.
Thank you very much. Let's give Dr. Stuckey a thank you. And have a good start of the new year. Now, you may not be a scientist, and you may wonder, I noticed, Paz, when you asked your question, it really registered all that isotopes and CO2s in the ice layers. A lot of us don't get it, and we wonder, why did Pastor Ed have this presentation here in light of all of the science? And this is what I want to make clear. The most critical question all humanity must answer is, who is Jesus Christ? And then, did He rise from the dead? We want to make sure that is the question that everybody entertains and contemplates. But often when we get enwrapped in this conflation, what the word he used between politics and science, and we're not discerning. We can create obstacles that focus people on global warming and never get them to ask the question, who is Jesus Christ? In other words, sometimes we are creating obstacles to that which is of utmost importance. And so if nothing else, if you didn't, capture everything of Dr. Stuckey, not because of you did a great job. I understood 90%. But if you didn't understand, everything, think twice when you engage in conversation if your position is more of a political persuasion that has been colored by what we heard last week, a commentator versus a true scientist, so that you can ask the question, who do you think Jesus Christ is? And then he rise from the dead. So thanks very much. And at the same time, Genesis does make it clear that we are stewards of God's creation. What a beautiful gift.